Hey, last week we did part one with Ross Young looking at cybersecurity budgets. And if you didn't catch last week, episode 255, go back and listen to it and then tune in for this one because we're going to finish up this discussion on one of the most important things you need to think about as a chief information security officer or a security leader. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy, and I'm here today with Ross Young, and we're going to be talking on part two of cybersecurity budgets and his upcoming book about cybersecurity's dirty secret, why most budgets go to waste. So quick little recap. First of all, Ross, welcome back.
Hey, thank you. Super excited to be back here.
And I had a blast last week. As you can tell, if you're watching, I'm at a different place, but that's okay. I'm up in BC on a regular basis, so no big deal. But if you didn't catch last week, quickly, we went ahead and we talked about the importance of budgeting in cybersecurity, how to maximize your investment, the question of risk reduction versus compliance, challenges that we had with cyber risk quantification, how to do total cost of ownership in cybersecurity, leveraging AI. If you want to get better efficiency with cybersecurity efficiency, how to prioritize cybersecurity projects and reducing the waste that we find in meetings. And finally, sort of a zero-based budgeting approach that might be able to help out as we present to things to the CFO. So we're going to pick up where we left off. And again, that was a 30-second summary of a 45-minute episode. And there's lots of great content in there. But any thoughts you want to say before we kind of get back into the groove about what we're talking about risk management with regard to spending money?
No, I think you covered it quite excellent. And also check out the Substack newsletter if you just want to quickly go and get links to any of the templates and see what they look like instead of watching the video. Sometimes it's a faster way to consume content.
That's a very good point. We do have Substack newsletters that come out every week. If you're not subscribing to it, do it because it gives you an opportunity to get a nice, concise summary of what we're talking about every week. Not that all the good stuff isn't valuable, and not that you can't play us at 1.5x or even 2x if you're in a hurry, but we'll still be able to get all the information to you, but it's a great way to add to your base of knowledge for cybersecurity. So let's pick up with a question, and something that you're famous for, and it came out a few years ago that I really like, was the OWASP Threat and Safeguard Matrix. Now, you mention it in your book, and you talk about if you're solving the wrong problems, well, then you're just wasting money. And the idea here is that organizations shouldn't just spend money to spend money. They ought to solve material threats. Now, can you share your thoughts on that? Maybe talk a little bit about the threat and safeguard matrix or chasm. I like that logo with the Tasmanian devil. And if it turns out, we might even do an entire episode on that. But let's get into that for a little bit right now.
Yeah, I think all CISOs understand that they have a finite budget. There's only so many people, there's only so much money to buy tools and implement certain processes. So what happens is we have to maximize the outcomes that we can achieve. And what happens is you have to pick which are the right problems to solve. Some organizations, insider threat may be your number one thing you have to worry about, places like CIA, where you may have moles and spies. Other organizations, it may all be all about fraud. Or keeping a website up on, you know, Cyber Monday, because that's when you make the majority of your sales. Every organization is just a little bit unique. And so what you need to do is understand what are the biggest threats that can cause a material impact to your organization, and then build a robust set of safeguards that's going to protect the business. And so if I'm Walmart and I'm worried about Cyber Monday, everything on high availability is my number one thing I have to put in. I'm going to have load balancers. I'm going to have things like CAPTCHAs and other stuff to keep bots away from my website. And if I was another web company, I would focus on the right type of safeguards that I need. But if you try to do everything, you have a diluted resources problem, which means you don't do anything really, really well, and you don't have enough money to buy the best tools that you need to really safeguard on those key threats. So that's why I think the TASM is so helpful. It lets you prioritize where you're going to build your defenses around your material threats to your organization.
Good insight. And so one of the things I like about the OWASP Threat and Safeguard Matrix is you really base it on some of the initial model that Sunil you had with regard to his model in the cybersecurity. And then his model was based, if you will, on the NIST cybersecurity framework. So it's kind of good models all the way down when we look at identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. And then instead of looking at it across things such as people and networks and tech and endpoints, et cetera, we're talking about the actual threats. And so the idea here is, from your construct on the OWASP threat and safeguard matrix, is that if somebody comes up and says, well, I think we should do X, you can say, okay, fine. What material threat is this being deployed against? And where is it? Is it helping to identify these threats? Is it to protect, detect, respond, recover? Where do we fit in? And if the person who's proposing a solution or a vendor is proposing a solution and they really can't articulate that, it might be a nice to have, it might have bells and whistles, and they might even give you a really nice benefit because vendors these days like to give you bribes. Hey, we'll give you a $50 gift card if you listen to our presentation, or we will do something or invite you to a fancy party at the next major security conference. But be careful when you do the acquisition, because if you're not buying a solution that materially impacts or reduces a material risk, you're, well, wasting money. And that was kind of the whole purpose of your writing that book, is because as a CISO, you have seen all these bad decisions made over the years. And these are ways that you can structurally look at it. That sound about right?
Exactly. And one of the exercises I would recommend for every CISO is take a look at the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report, the DBIR, because you're going to see what the top three attacks are each year. And you better have a playbook to stop those threats. Here's what they are for this year, just in case you haven't read it. It's phishing, no surprise. It's identity-based attacks, and it's vulnerabilities on internet-facing systems that are unpatched that you need to fix. And so if you haven't figured those out, and this is the most common attack that's going to happen to any organization, you're just not even planning. You're just negligent in my mind. So I think looking through those examples is really key. And maybe you're going to tell me, hey, Ross, we don't deploy any software, 100% SaaS-based. Cool. You've checked that one off. But at least you took the time to spend a little bit of time in preparation to figure out what you're going to do to keep your organization secure.
Yeah, I was on a call yesterday where one of the presenters was talking about compliance, and her whole background was setting up compliance and things like that, and said one of the things that we tend to do is we get this entire huge list of compliance requirements, and we figure we got to check all the boxes and do everything. And I love that she had one illustration. It was a gate that was set up, and it had little covers in the slats on the side. It had a push bar to lock it in there, and there's a camera over there. And there's, you could just walk around the whole fence. I mean, it's like this wide, and then walk around. I said, but you could go through a checklist perspective and say, do I have a camera?
Check.
Do I have limited visibility? Have these things to check? Do we have a crash bar, which means it opens once you check? I guess I'm secure. I've got all my little compliance things, but you just walk around it. And so use your brain. We find out that also is one of the frustrating things for me as a CISO is I will get these questionnaires from prospective customers, clients, et cetera, saying, fill out our 427 question risk assessment. Well, some of these things are just not applicable, but they want you to fill them in there. And I think, like, no, we don't develop stuff. If you had said, if all you are is COTS, commercial off-the-shelf software, if you're a military person, or SaaS, basically meaning you're not writing your own tools, all that dev stuff is irrelevant. Well, don't waste your time and effort in trying to create a compliance program for a dev shop that doesn't exist. Rather, refocus your efforts on the things that you think are important. And then, to a certain extent, the DBIR is a great report, but remember, that's time late. That's 1 year time late. And if you look at the delta from year to year, there's some variation in there. But you know what's going to happen? I think for the 2026 report would come out, we're going to see an awful lot about AI. And for cybersecurity perspective, what do we think those problems are going to be? We're going to be a little crystal balling here in October and say it's probably going to be leaks, people putting information in the models that shouldn't, when they try to set up an AI and it goes ahead and it grabs databases or it transmits information it should not, people uploading proprietary information, trying to generate client deliverables that don't meet the standard of due care with respect to originality. All these things will come in there. And so you can take this threat and safeguard matrix and at the same process that we would to look at external threats, try to anticipate where your concerns are with artificial intelligence. What issues have come up with your discussions with your executives about AI? Throw it into the TASM and then look at each box and sit down and say, what would help me protect against this? What would help me recover against that? And that framework, I think, is going to be much more useful than just a big, long checklist that somebody else just throws at you. And probably they're not going to read the details anyway. They're just going to look for where the no answers were.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point of what is it you're going to put into the TASM, if you will. If you look on the OWASP TASM website, you'll see that, one, there's a list of like 30 common threats I think most organizations are going to encounter. And then there's even a separate section where I highlight the top 7 AI risks that I think that most companies are likely to encounter as well. Too often I found people saying, hey, help me build an organization that can stop AI threats. Well, AI threats is vague. Which AI threat are you trying to stop? Are you trying to stop people uploading sensitive data to ChatGPT? Are you trying to stop your chatbots from hallucinating? Very, very different solutions and very, very different safeguards that you need. So you can go through the examples in the OWASP website and actually look and see how they play out and what solutions you're going to bring. The other piece that I would also say is to also include the metrics section. You'll see like a metrics that matter and how we go from, okay, now we know these are the risks that we want to govern. What are we going to do on a monthly basis to see, are we getting better, worse, or staying the same in our ability to stop these material threats?
Yeah, this is a very good point because metrics that matter are a term I like to use. And I had done a presentation a couple of weeks ago for a financial institution looking about AI risks and essentially built out for them a risk model. Maybe we'll turn that into a future episode, but looking at very specific things and then concluding with here are the things you should be tracking because you can expect what you inspect, but if you can't measure it, you're not going to be able to quantify it. If you can't quantify it, you don't know if you're making progress. So that's some further insight. We could probably keep going into this. I think we've already got ideas for 2 more episodes coming up. But let's go ahead and continue with some of the things you've been talking about with regard to your book and finance and how CISOs screw up in their budget in their first 180 days. Can you talk about how you think you use a tool like a murder board to go ahead and help solve this problem?
Yeah. So one of the most common things I see an organizational CISO do when they step into a place is they look and they see, here's the 50, 80 different tools that are here. And they think, oh, in my last organization, we ran a tool, let's just call it CrowdStrike or whatever the tool may be. Why are we using it here? Why are we using Xvendor? And so the first thing they do is they try to rip and replace so that they standardize on tools that they like, tools that they're familiar with. And ultimately what that means is they've just increased the budget. Right? I'm going to have to buy 5 or 10 new tools so it looks like my old organization. I'm going to have to run them in tandem for 3 to 6 month process so I can make sure that we securely transition and there's no outages and impacts. And so I have to go beg money from the CFO to do that. And I think that's the wrong thing to do. So what I like to do is to do something called a murder board. What I like to do is list out the 50 different tools that we have and then show how many servers they're deployed on. Is it 50% of the servers? Is it 80% of the servers? Or it could be endpoints. And then after I know that, well, what is the coverage, right, that they have with the features that are turned on? Do I have all the features turned on? Or have they created too many alerts for the SOC and I've just turned them all off? And so essentially I've deployed vaporware, right? So seeing those things. And then I even like to take a step further and say, okay, now let's look at the telemetry coming back. Do I log into a portal and I see, okay, here's how many machines I have. Well, how many actually came back in the last 30 days? Because you'd be surprised how many, even though you've installed an agent on the endpoint, maybe it got turned off. Maybe there's a firewall rule that blocks it from beaconing back to the portal. And so all these little things happen where you dilute the true coverage of what you have. And so now when you start to think about this murder board, you can go in and say, I want you to explain to me why these 5 tools that look really diluted are providing any value because I'm just not seeing it. And that question is the right line of thinking where you can start to maybe get rid of three or five tools. And now you have a couple $1 million that then you can go ask for the five tools you wanted, and you didn't have to acquire additional funding from the CFO. So I think if you take that murder board approach first, you can do a lot more things and reduce a lot more waste.
Well, that's very good insight. And in a way, it's a, kind of like what we talked about in the last episode with regard to a zero-based review, but we're not zeroing everything out. Rather, what we're going to do is we're going to pick each and everything up and try to justify, why is this here? Why is this here? Why is this here? Another thing I think that we often do is that we do get, as you had mentioned, in our comfort zone. So in our last job, we had products A, B, C, D, and E. We come here and they got W, X, Y, and Z. Well, I'm comfortable over here. Don't forget that if you change out a tool, it's not just the acquisition cost. When you talk about total cost of ownership, you got to do the hosting for it, and you have to train your people. And if they've got to run two different tools in parallel for 5 months to chop over, and they don't have all the time to do that, you're going to have to add additional people, at which point you're going to have to take them away in the back end, and that creates all kinds of problems. So when you come into a new job as a CISO, stop and look and sit back. When I used to teach leadership in the military, we used to talk about different models, and then it would be you're relieving somebody of a job. You're coming with a new command, and you either are relieving somebody who was a lousy commander or a good commander, and they were performing poorly or they're performing well. So if you go in there and the person was a lousy leader and they weren't performing, then you got to come in there and crack the whip, because that's why you got hired, to fix things. If you come in there and they were a lousy leader, but the organization was performing, they were figuring it out themselves. Don't get in there and mess things around. Sit back and look and listen, because your people that you've inherited in your new job might have already mastered a bunch of stuff and they just ignored this useless boss. You can then become a learner to a certain extent. And then, if you will, run to the head of the parade that's already going in the right direction. If you come into an organization that has an excellent leader but poor performance, it's probably not the leader's problem. If you come in there doing business as usual, it's not going to work. It's structural problems, either in terms of the people or the technology or even the budgeting. And you got to go solve that. And that's going to require you to communicate up top. But in the fourth corner, when you come into a job where prior boss was good and the performance is excellent, what's the first thing you ought to do? Go get a cup of coffee. Why? Because it's running by itself and they're used to having strong leadership. And so what you're going to do is you're going to become the agent for your team to say, let me know what you need and I'll get it. One of the most effective CIOs that I knew was not an IT person at all. I kind of joked that he couldn't spell IT, but he was pretty good at golf and he was outstanding at networking. And the staff would say, hey, we need $1 million for this or whatever. And he'd go out and play around the golf, if you will, with the CFO and come back with the money in his hand. And he said, here you go. So he was a great breadwinner in a situation like that. So think about that when you come in there. And as I say, this started with the context of the murder boards, but I'm extending it into your leadership style, because you have to stop, look, and listen to see what's going on and avoid the temptation to say, hey, at my last job, all I had was a hammer, so I guess everything here looks like a nail. It's like, no, there might be some Phillips head screws around here. You, as a CISO, might need to improve your tool set, and you do so by diagnosing how well that organization is performing. Are they meeting their challenges? Can you go ahead and use tools like you've had, such as the TASM, to go ahead and match the actual material threats to the solution sets that are there? And if you find there's a good overlap and it's working well, sit back and relax a little bit, because you inherited a good situation.
Yeah, the other big thing that I learned from the murder board exercise is the things that we want to initially replace may be the worst things to do. Like if I say, oh, I have to have CrowdStrike, but the EDR is working successfully, it's just a personal preference. What did I just do? I just went in and said, hey, you guys are all stupid. You're choosing the wrong tools. You guys suck. Go fix it. And they're going to be like, who is this new CISO who came in, thinks we're all a bunch of dummies, tells us to replace something that's working really, really good, and is just blowing money away? Like, that's not a good way to build rapport in the first 90 days, right?
That's a very good point. Now, another thing you find out that may not be in the first 90 days, but it'll definitely be during your tenure as a CISO, is looking at master service agreements, the MSAs. And these things come up for renewal from time to time. And they also get introduced when you have a new company. And sometimes that's the longest part of procurement, is getting all this stuff through legal. They have to go ahead and make sure the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and that is the right things that they want, happy, not glad, and that stuff like that, which is parenthetically, when you're talking to a startup, when they say, oh, I want to go ahead and sell to the Fortune 500 for my first 10 customers. I said, you'll go bankrupt. You'll run out of money before Fortune 500 companies will sign 10 contracts. That could take a long, long time. But if you're negotiating master service agreements, what are good ways to save money and some tips in that space?
You know, I'll just say master service license agreements were the thing I never knew were going to be the most challenging thing for me as a CISO. I always thought getting the money was the hard point. And the truth is, it's actually very easy to get money if you have a compelling argument. But spending a year in procurement, oh my gosh, I had no idea what it was like with, you know, large company bureaucracy. And so what I would say is there's always this kind of divorce attorney approach where you want everything in the contract and the vendor wants to give you nothing. And so you have to find that happy middle ground where both teams are okay with things. And there's certain things I would really look to push so I could save my company money. One I would really force is, how much does the contract price change on a 3-year re-up, right? So does it only go up by a capped amount of 3%? Something like that feels reasonable. So it goes up with, you know, cost of inflation and things like that. So the vendor can make a little bit more money, but at the same time, it's not like they jumped 50% and gouged you once you spend all the time to deploy that tooling in your organization. So things like that are really, really key that you want to put in your contract. And then what you're going to see is your attorneys are going to ask for things that I personally think are quite unreasonable. We want unlimited liability from this company. Well, what company wants to go under because one contract went away in a bad fashion? Nobody. So they don't want to do that. They're going to put it at like 3 times the price of the contract or something like that. So understand that that's already going to be their negotiating terms, and already have discussions with your procurement team to say, this is where we're going to settle if they give any pushback. And you know what? I actually think this is the wrong thing. Maybe we just buy insurance and self-insure. Because, you know, if we buy something from a vendor, they're just going to add a markup on it. So we're going to pay more on their insurance than if we had just bought our own insurance. And guess what? If we have to do that on 50 different vendors, that's 50 different insurances that we're being charged for instead of just one that could be across all the different entities. So think a little bit smarter in how you do some of these master service license agreements and what you're truly requesting. And these are some of the tips that I really go through in the course and in the book.
Yeah, that's a good insight. I just finished renegotiating a contract with a security provider that I've worked with for a number of years. And they, the new rep that they had said, oh, we have a 10% uplift for 2026. I said, what the heck is an uplift? Oh, we're just increasing our prices. And I said, no, inflation is not 10%. The cost of doing business is not 10%. We're actually not using all of our licenses. We're below your minimum count. It's the SMB problem you have is that if they say, hey, 1,000 license and a more, and you've got 600 or 700 seats, and the least you can buy is 1,000, you're already overpaying. And I basically, you know, working with our COO, pushed back and said, look, if you want to hold on to this business, you can't add your uplift or whatever you want to call it. And they came back and they said, all right, fine. We want to keep you. You've been around for a long time. I was able to get a 3% limit into the contract. No, because typically whomever writes the contract has it, they have printed right onto their forms. So the whole idea is that if you are the person on the one side, if you're the vendor, you're going to try to make it as difficult as possible for your customer to make contract changes. And also figure out, is that the hill you want to die on? If they can't give you the 3%, you're going to walk away. And just like, as you said, the legal department may say, oh, we want infinite coverage. It's like, no. One of the things I always did as a small business owner is when I would do an NDA with somebody, I would write the NDA and I would want to use mine. And the reason I said is this. Sign either line. It's like when you have two kids and they're arguing over a piece of cake. Okay, you cut the cake, but you pick the first piece. So the incentive is to aim right down the middle. And so my thought is that if you make things mutually incentivized, you'll end up with a better outcome. Another kind of dilemma that it's not really a dilemma, it's always kind of a model. You used to say better, faster, cheaper, pick any two. And in consulting, that really was kind of the rule. If you want it better, you want a really good job, you want it fast, make it be cheap. And if you want it fast and you want it cheap, it's not going to be very good, and so on. So there's always some sort of an offset. It's like a three-legged thing. But what are your thoughts about that? And were you able to use that, one of your previous employers, to save them a whole bunch of money?
Yeah, I look for ways to accomplish all three. And part of the ways that I do this is really looking for what is the win-win solution for everybody. And I'll just give you an example. When I was at a large financial bank, there was a team that I worked with that ran the Jenkins infrastructure. And it had a lot of vulns that nobody wanted to be there. And I hated having to cover that on vuln management reports saying, here is one of our riskiest systems. And of course, if anybody knows anything about Jenkins, it's the admin of admins to deploy everywhere in your organization. So like one of the worst things to have a lot of vulns on, right? And so I went and I talked to the team and I said, can we all agree this is not where we want to be long term? Absolutely. So let's figure out a way to build Jenkins 2.0. And it doesn't even have to be Jenkins. It could be an AWS version of a CI/CD pipeline. What would that look like? How could we do this ephemeral? How could we do it serverless? What could we come up with that would be better? And the team came back and said, here's what we could do and build it totally serverless and make it just amazing, right? The CI/CD pipeline 2.0. Perfect. How much do you think it would cost and how much time would it take to get there? Oh, we think it's going to take, you know, a good year of building this out. We're a 10-person team, so let's call this $2 million at 200K a headcount. Okay, got it. Now, if we did this, how much operations and maintenance would you save? Well, right now, we're currently spending about 80% of our time on maintenance. Ooh, so 8 people out of a 10-person team, that's 1.6 million.
Six.
Oh my goodness. So how fast could we, or how much would the maintenance be in version 2.0? Oh, we think we'd get down to 10%. Yeesh. Oh, that's a pretty amazing savings. So you're talking about 7 headcount that don't have to do that work anymore and could be building a different product for your organization. So now it may cost $2 million, but you're going to save $1.4 million a year. I can take that argument and start to make it a win-win for everybody. The developers get to say, hey, I built version 2.0 and made better improvements. Security says, hey, we built version 2.0 that's serverless and doesn't have all these vulnerabilities. The IT manager gets to go and say, hey, we built version 2.0 and now I have 7 headcount to dedicate to this new business initiative and build this product. And then the chief financial officer gets to talk about how we're saving $1.4 million every year. So like overall, it's a win-win-win. It's cheaper, it's faster, and it's better. And so when you look at things from this, how do I reduce the toil of operations and maintenance and then build it into a way that speaks business literacy to the chief financial officer, to the manager, everybody is totally on board. And now it's when they pitch the project to the senior team, it's we already have security on board. We already have the funding on board. Everybody's excited to do this. Let's go. And I think that is just a way to get those cheaper, faster, better projects as win-wins.
And that's awesome. And really what you're doing is you're not just improving the system. You're actually replacing the inefficient process with one that's going to work a whole lot better, which is kind of tangentially associated with one of the things you talk about in your book is process improvement. And one of the things that you had done is taken an organization that had a patching mean of over 300 days to get their patches done to under 30. That sounds like a spectacular. That's a 10-to-1 improvement or more. How in the world were we able to do something like that?
Yeah. So one of the things I think we don't do enough is take some of the older lessons of lean process improvement and Six Sigma and apply that into cybersecurity. And so I'll just give you a classic example. When I hear vulnerability management, most people are talking about, here's these three CVEs we need to go and fix. They're super high, super critical. We got them on a number of systems. That's so very tactical. It's so very much in the weeds, especially for a CISO role. Instead, I think we need to work at a higher order. And let me give you an example of what I mean by that. If you were to take your vulnerability management process, break it down into the 10, 15 steps. Hey, we have to scan our internet-facing IPs to find a vulnerability. Then we have to actually know what team this belongs to. Then we have to actually go and see if there's a fix. Then we have to go and see how important this is compared to all the other fixes they need to do. And you mark across all the 10, 15 steps that are in your vuln management process. And then you say, well, how long does each step take? Does it take this many minutes, this many days? And you put all that down. And now what you do is you call a council together of the smartest people in your organization. Someone from the server team, someone from the apps team, someone from the database team, someone from the network team. These, you know, people who've been around a long time and really know what happens in your organization. And you say, okay, right now we're patching at 300 days. This is unsustainable. How fast could we get on each of these steps if we were to totally blow away our existing process and do it completely from scratch? And they're going to say, well, instead of scanning every 2 hours, we could scan, you know, every 20 minutes if we want. Okay. How long to, you know, maybe identify the right owner? Well, if we had things tagged accordingly, we could get that in seconds. It wouldn't be, you know, this witch hunt to figure out who actually owns these things. And so you go through each of these things. And then what you can do is you can actually look at the opportunities to save time. Maybe something that takes a week because it's a weekly change approval board that people have to attend before they can push a new release could be just something you put into a GitHub approval process that can go out in a couple of hours, right? And so now when you start to measure that, you can start to say, if we just fix these two out of these 15 sub-processes, we could save 80% of the time it takes patching. Amazing. Now, how do we make that an enterprise initiative to solve that thing? And now everybody's patching gets faster. And that's the type of thinking I think CISOs, when they do and they improve that broken process or the slow bureaucratic process, we can really change the organization and leave a lasting impression for the better.
And that also is a cooperative venture you do with the IT team, because you're working with the developers. You're going to say, look, a lot of times security comes in there like, oh man, these guys are going to put all these restrictions on us. They're going to make our life harder, more difficult. But you can actually come in there and say, hey, I'm really on your side. You guys are flailing a lot. You're trying really, really hard to get something done, and it's taking a long time. What if we could work together to improve on this? Would that make your life better? Well, sure. Would that make the process better? Yes. Would make the company a little bit happier? Of course it would. And so what you find then is that by approaching it collaboratively, by saying, I'm here from, you know, you see the old thing, like, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. It's like, I'm from IT security, I'm here to help. They're like, yeah, stay away. In this particular case, you can start to build that reputation and say, all right, Ross, what do you got this thing? Because the last three times you came in here to help out, we were able to produce some really significant benefits that made everybody's lives better. So I think it's a mindset change, but you're absolutely right, is that finding that bottleneck in the process, and it means mapping out the process to get from A to B, might have 15 steps. And you might find out that steps 3 and 14 have these huge wait cycles in there, and everything else queues up like a Gantt chart. You figure out where the critical path is and look at the dependencies, and then just try to figure out where that wait cycle is and see if you can compress it with either changing the way you do it. So I love that, and that's really great. It could be a huge way to save money. As they say, it'll build your credibility with your IT department. Now, in one of your chapters in your book, you emphasize that the price of ignorance is always higher. And in your analysis, you say organizations still stop breaches even if they got 60 or more different security tools. And the concept that you talk about is the effective protection score. Tell us a little bit more about what you're thinking here.
Yeah, so similar to the murder board, it's about, is this tool on 50% of the endpoints or servers or 100%? Because if it isn't, well, we're just flying blind. And this was just my example. I went to an organization and they said, hey, we rolled out the WAF everywhere. Great. That sounds like a good accomplishment. Amazing. But then when I actually started talking to the developers behind the scenes, they're like, yeah, we turned off all the WAF rules. They, you know, were impacting our website. So we really didn't deploy the WAF. I mean, yeah, we checked a box saying we're doing it, but if all the rules are turned off, it's a worthless WAF, right? So this is where you need to understand this effective protection score of understanding how it's deployed, how effective it's deployed. And then what I would also say is to look at maybe the most important question. How many real attacks did this stop last year? Because if it stopped 10 real attacks or, you know, 20,000 real attacks, now I can kind of justify the value of these things. And even dig into that question. Were the attacks that it found and stopped the only tool in your arsenal that could stop it? Or would it, is it redundant? Maybe I have three tools that all stop the same attack. Well, maybe I don't have to buy all three tools. I could simplify with just one tool, right? So things like that, when you start to really pull behind the scenes of how effective something is at keeping your organization secure is really, really key. And you're going to figure out that these tools are, a lot of them are just not giving you the value for your dollar, the outcomes that you really desire. And unless there is a compliance checkbox that says, thou shalt have this tool, let's call it SIEM or DLP or something else that's required by a law, then you may not have to have that tool at all.
And also consider prudent business practice. And what do I mean by that? When was the last time a seatbelt saved your life? I've never had a seatbelt save my life, yet I wear it every single time I move my automobile. Why? It's prudent business practice. In the event of a low probability, high impact outcome event, like a head-on collision or something like that, that could be the difference between death or serious injury and walking off with a short, some bruises and a sore shoulder. So as you look through your list of, has this actually stopped real world attacks in the last 12 months? Also allow for the fact that it didn't stop an attack because the attack didn't occur, but if it had. So for example, if you had said, hey, we have built this resiliency where we are able to go ahead and shift off of our mail scan. I had this conversation very recently because we used Proofpoint, and Proofpoint went down when Amazon went down. The AWS US East One had their DNS problem just this past week. And we're going, okay, what would it take then to go ahead and throw the switch, if you will, take the jumper cables and stick them up over here? And talking to the IT team, they're like, well, we change this, we change that, it's something like that. Well, in an enterprise, if I have an enterprise CISO, I would want to go ahead and have a way to say, although Amazon has never gone down like this before, well, so what? Now we got it, we've got our black swan. But what are you doing in the future so that we can do that? And have you tested that? Can you go ahead and set your times to live? Let's get down to 300 seconds. Why do you need more than a 5-minute time to live? We used to do a 7,200 second time to live because it would jam up the network with all this text traffic. Refreshing a IP address under DNS takes nothing at all in terms of bandwidth anymore, but it gives you phenomenal agility. So these are the sort of things that as you expand your thinking, absolutely right. Look at the performance results, real world attacks that it's done there, and the coverage, as you had said, how many, what percent of your system's on. So as we get in close to the end of the show here, but one other thing I want to bring up is the concept of saving money on human costs. And a lot of times you think about that because they're doing headcount cuts or cutting back and things like that. But you want some ideas like personal values exercise and roses, thorns, and buds to align employee motivation with the strategic goals. And you're going to improve loyalty and retention. That all sounds really good, but how does that work?
So one of the first things that I see is, how do we make sure our best people and really all the people in our organization are engaged? And I like to do this exercise called a personal values exercise, where what you do is you rank the 50 things that you value in the workplace. And then that's really, really telling, because if I'm a manager over someone looking for adventure, looking for excitement, looking for, you know, high pay, I need to understand that in order to coach and mentor and manage that person effectively. Meanwhile, if someone else is looking for a lifestyle balance, a work from home, other things, that's very different in how I'm going to coach and manage that employee. And so that's the first thing. Then the second thing that I like to do is the easiest, cheapest exercise you'll ever do. You go buy a stack of Post-it notes like the following here, right? And what you do is you give everyone on your team 9 different Post-its. And you say, I want you to think of 3 ideas for each of these columns. The first is what's working well. The second is what's not working. And the third is what new ideas should we try? So they're going to go and put 3 ideas in each of those things with the Post-its. And then what you're going to do is you got 10 people, you got 30 ideas in each column. Okay, let's just look at the trends across all of these ideas in this 30 Post-its. And you're going to summarize those in that. Here's the 3 themes that I think that are really emerging. Okay, these are the 3 things that are working really good. Don't touch those. Don't screw those up. Keep those working. These are the 3 bad things that nobody likes in the organization. Okay, as a manager, I need to figure out how we're going to fix those things. And not only that, but I actually know who has the right values that may be best in line with trying to take care of these things. They're actually open to fixing these things. And then last but not least, what are the new ideas I should try? When you do this approach from the Post-it example, you are getting in all of their feedback. They're bought in and they're seeing you're championing their ideas and you're enabling them to do these things. That is such an inclusive workplace. That makes a lot of sense. And employees love it when their ideas are championed and pushed forward. So I would highly recommend this during every strategic offsite.
Yeah, and that's great. And as you mentioned about the idea of inclusion, we have our own ideas, good or bad, about what that word means. But letting people be included in the decision-making process, because the people who do it every day as part of their job are going to have better insights than those of us who might be 1 or 2 or even 3 layers removed from that, because we're dealing with executives, we're dealing with strategy, we're dealing with the board and things such as that. But when people own part of a decision, when they help participate in it, they're going to defend it and they're going to support for it. And so one of the best ideas that I've heard in terms of getting people to want to do what you want them to do is they can think it's their idea. And even if it's partially their idea, hey, this is for you. We did this because you thought it was a great idea and it works really well. And so good for you on that one. So any last thoughts before we wrap up here? Because we've got some great insights. We've now covered 2 episodes on your book, Cybersecurity's Dirty Secret, Why Most Budgets Go to Waste. Any update yet in terms of when it might come out? Are we still looking like it might be on track for later this year?
It's definitely coming out before the end of the year. Right now, we're in the final steps of getting some testimonials to put on the back cover and just the last tweaks of the editing. But I will say, if anybody is interested in learning these lessons and reading the content early, please check out the course on CISO Tradecraft. You can get access to watch the videos, to get the templates now and start playing around. Many of the templates we also give away in our free template section. So don't feel like you have to wait. You can actually get early access to the content. And if you want to wait for the book, please just watch what we do on LinkedIn. We'll be posting it like crazy there when it gets time. And I'm happy to sign the book at any of the conferences. I'm sure we're going to have things at Black Hat and others as it starts to become, you know, much more popular. And I hope it really helps a lot of people.
Well, I think it will. I think it might even earn a place in the Cybersecurity Canon Hall of Fame of great books. So, Ross Young, it's been awesome having you here, talking with you for the last couple episodes here on CISO Tradecraft. Stay tuned for Ross's new book, and don't forget that you can keep coming back, getting good information from the CISO Tradecraft website. If you're not subscribing to us, please do so. We also have a Substack newsletter, which I had mentioned. Follow us on LinkedIn, because we're a whole lot more than just a podcast. We've got some really good information. And follow Mr. Ross Young on LinkedIn, because he's got a lot of great stuff too, and always wonderful for ideas for thought. So thank you again for being part of our audience. This is your host, G. Mark Hardy. And if you learned something today, share it on social media. Let other people know where you're getting your knowledge to help out your career, so we can improve the lives and the careers of others and improve their cybersecurity tradecraft. So thank you again for being part of our audience. And until next time, stay safe out there.